Exodus. Application from 2 Samuel 12:7 through 12:23. The seventh talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on May 12, 1996 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We're going to forge on to Exodus chapter 6 tonight. So I'd like you to turn with me to 2 Samuel 7. No, 2 Samuel 12. Sorry, 2 Samuel. This may seem like the wrong way to get to Exodus 6. But last week, Jack mentioned something that I'd like to talk about a little bit. If you recall, last week you were talking about in Exodus chapter 5, God had told Moses to tell the people of Israel that to show them the signs and to announce the fact that God was going to leave them out of slavery in Egypt and to the Promised Land. And Moses went, and they believed him. They accepted the fact that he was sent from God. And Moses then went to the Pharaoh and said, "Let us go." And the Pharaoh said, "No way." And in fact, the Pharaoh made things more difficult for the Israelites. Now they had to make the same number of bricks, but they had to make them without the Egyptians providing the hay to put in the bricks. So the Israelites had to not only make the same number of bricks, but they had to find their own hay. And whenever they didn't meet their quotas, the Egyptian taskmasters, would whip the Israelite foreman. So these Israelite foremen, they went to the Pharaoh and explained the situation. We can't make more bricks. It's humanly impossible for us to make the same number of bricks and have to do this gathering of the straw in addition to what we were doing before. And the Pharaoh said, "You're just lazy," and gave them no hope that he would moderate his demands. So they walked out of this meeting, and Moses and Aaron were standing there waiting for them when they had gone to see Pharaoh. And the foremen came out. These are Israelites. They came out and said to Moses, "You've just made life miserable for us." So Moses prays to God, saying, "This doesn't make sense. You sent me to provide deliverance for your people, and things have just gotten harder." So I was talking about that and the significance of that for, well, that when we look at the book of Exodus as a whole, what we have to see is God had a longer term plan. He was doing what he said he was going to do. It's just that on the short run, it didn't look like he was doing what he was going to do. Things were getting harder. But for God's purposes, it was important that things get harder. One, because it would make the salvation all that much more magnificent and glorious and a better demonstration of God's power. And secondly, something that I ran across in a commentary that makes sense to me, God is kind of driving a wedge between the Israelis and the Israelites and their life in Egypt, bringing them to a point where they would like to leave. And we'll see that there are hints that there is a certain amount of reluctance to their leaving Egypt. Okay, so then the issue arose, how can we apply this teaching that we're seeing here? Is it not true that they were faced with a different kind of situation than we find ourselves in? How can this be applied? So I'd like to talk about that a little bit before we get into Exodus 6, and then I'll throw it open and we can discuss it and ask questions and make comments and all that sort of thing. What I've been arguing right from the beginning in talking about Exodus is that, and this is not just true of Exodus, but the Old Testament in general, that my assumption is that it's the same God. It was the same God in 2000 BC that it is today. He hasn't changed, and his overall purposes have not changed. And the way that he operates, his character, the things that he values have not changed. And that we as human beings are essentially the same as the Israelites in 2000 BC, or in 1400 BC, or if you take low dating, 1200 BC. But it doesn't matter. And in fact, that it is a mistake for us to think that we are essentially different and that we would respond differently to the same kinds of stresses and temptations and pressures. Let's then think about a comparison between the two. I've maintained that those things are the same, but there are some differences. And let's try to compare the situation of Israel with the situation that we find ourselves in. Israel had been promised that they would be given possession of the promised land long before the events of Exodus. God had promised to Moses that Palestine would be given to his descendants as a possession forever. And God took Abraham to Palestine, and Abraham lived in that land and traversed that land while he was alive. It was only later that his descendants left that land and went into Egypt. So they should have assumed, the Israelites should have assumed, that at the time would come when they would return and possess it more fully than Abraham ever did. And there are indications that they did understand that. Joseph, when he died, asked that his descendants promise that his bones would be carried back from Egypt to Israel. So at the time that Joseph died, he was believing the promise that God had made that the Israelites would return to that land. But God didn't, as far as I can recall. I was looking back through Genesis last night, and it's possible that there's a verse there that indicates some kind of time gauge as to how long they will be in Egypt, but I couldn't find it. In any case, it isn't very specific. They did not know exactly when this would happen. If they knew at all, they knew in very rough terms. So, they have this promise. The promise that they will be led out of Egypt and they will return to the land that God was going to give them forever. Another aspect of their situation. The promise was given to a nation and not to individuals. None of them as individuals could be certain that individual was going to make it back to Palestine. Any one of them might die before they get there. The promise was made to the nation and not to an individual. Thirdly, Moses announced that God was going to begin this process to the people of Israel. God had appeared to Moses in the burning bush and told Moses what he was up to and that he was going to begin this process and that Moses was going to lead them out of Egypt and back into the promised land. And Moses returned to Egypt and told the people of Israel that this was the case. So they know that God is moving at this point in time when we begin Exodus. However, in giving this announcement, God avoided giving all of the details, and he did not give a precise timeline. So again, there are details that are left out. It's not exactly clear how God is going to bring this about. And there is room for maneuver in the promises that God made. Okay, so how would this have affected the Israelite in terms of their everyday experience? If we're thinking about the time when Moses has returned to Egypt, has told them that God is going to move and he's going to lead them out of Egypt and into Palestine, and yet they're still working as slaves, how would this impact their everyday experience? Well, one is that I've already mentioned, an individual might not make it. Any one of the individuals might die before the realization of this promise. Secondly, the experience of every individual is going to be different. Although, as we see it in Exodus, on the whole, things get worse for a period of time before they get better, I would assume that the fates of individual Hebrews would have been different. There would have been times when things got particularly difficult, say for a foreman when he's getting flogged. And there were probably other times when things were not quite so bad, like the day they got sick and had to lie in bed all day or something, as happens in One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. So I would suspect that their fates varied throughout this period. So what we have in Exodus is just this general trend of things getting worse before they get better. And during this period of time, an individual may have appealed to God for help. But in their everyday experience, in the midst of floggings, I don't find it at all hard to believe that one of the Hebrews would have appealed to God for relief from that particular distress. And that in the midst of that particular stress, God may or may not have brought relief. We don't know. But the important thing, well, the thing that God is showing them in Exodus is that God's promises as to what he will do are as certain as God is trustworthy. That the issue that keeps coming up is God the kind of God who will come through on the promises that he has made? And God is determined to come through on those promises. He doesn't always do it in the way they anticipate. There are times when it looks like he isn't going to come through with them. And that's what they fear. It's on that short term, when things get bad, things go not the way that they expected them to go, when there are strange twists and turns in the fates, I'm sure to them it looked difficult to believe that God would come through on his promises. But in Exodus as a whole, God not only came through, but he came through in rather remarkable fashion. Okay, if that's the experience of the Israelites, then what is our experience? We do have one promise from God that we can count on, and that is a promise of deliverance from our sinfulness. That for everyone who is a believer, that God has guaranteed that he will root that sin out of us and make us righteous. But on this, there is no timeline. God has not told us how fast that progress will be made. And in fact, we can be assured that it will not be completed in this lifetime. And we don't know how much progress will be made in this lifetime. But God is determined and has promised that he will fulfill that, bring that into being. So that's one promise of deliverance one promise from God that we can count on. And it's as good as God's trustworthiness. However, we have no promise for deliverance from our daily trials and sufferings. God has not promised that. The kinds of problems that we run into, some of them are long-standing, some of them are of short duration. They may or may not be resolved in this lifetime. There may be problems that we are faced with that will plague us from now until we die. There are others that God may resolve shortly, or may have already resolved. But I think from the biblical record we can see that God does listen to our pleas for help. Whatever problems we do have, God is a willing ear, and He does listen. He is a personal God, one who takes interest in us individually. And He does indeed empathize with our suffering. It may not seem like it, because he seems to be so slow to respond. But He does indeed empathize with us. However, His purposes are extremely complex, and that's one of the things we see in Exodus. He's trying to accomplish a lot of things. He's weaving together this extremely complex tapestry. And as a result, for us as human beings, it's hard to sort out what exactly He's doing at any given point in time and why He's doing what He's doing. So it seems very reasonable that in our life's experience, there would be many things that happen to us that we never can adequately explain. We never do really know why God did what He did. Okay, let's look at 2 Samuel chapter 12. This is an incident that I read recently as we discussed it in the class that I'm doing with kids on the Old Testament. And I think this is a very interesting, well, the Old Testament is full of interesting stories. This is just one of them. And it's one that I had forgotten about. This is about King David, sometime in the middle of his career as king of Israel. He had, prior to the events in chapter 12, he had committed adultery with Bathsheba. Bathsheba was a woman who was married to one of David's commanders in the army. The army had been sent away to wage war because it was spring, and that's what you do in the spring. And while this commander was away, Uriah, David took an interest in Bathsheba and committed adultery with her. And subsequently found out that she was pregnant with a child. So David was nervous that his action could not be concealed. So he brought Uriah back from the front, back home to Jerusalem, hoping that that Uriah would sleep with Bathsheba while he was home on leave, and that his deed could then be covered up. But Uriah didn't do that. His solidarity with the soldiers on the front was such that he didn't feel like he could in good conscience enjoy the benefits of being home while the other soldiers were fighting. So he was not cooperative with David's plan. As a result then, David decided to have Uriah put to death. And he had Joab, the commander of the army, put Uriah in the front, in the very front line, an attack on the most heavily defended area of the enemy's lines, the city walls. They attacked, and then Joab commanded that all their fighters withdraw, leaving Uriah to be slaughtered. And that's exactly what happened. So then David married Bathsheba. So David thinks that he has succeeded in covering up his sin, his act of adultery. But after the child is born, Nathan the prophet comes to David and tells David a story which illustrates what David had done. And David, not realizing that it illustrated what he had done, condemned the bad guy in the story. And Nathan said, "You have condemned yourself." But essentially, David had done the very thing that David recognized as being evil. Then Nathan says to David that the child is going to die. Let's read. Let's see, where should we start? Let's start with verse 7 of chapter 12. Here's what Nathan says to David after Nathan has condemned him. Nathan then said to David, "You are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, it is I who anointed you king over Israel, and it is I who delivered you from the hand of Saul. I also gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your care. And I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have added to you many more things like these. Why have you despised the word of the Lord by doing evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword. You have taken his wife to be your wife and have killed him with the sword of the sons of Ammon. Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. I will even take your wives before your eyes and give them to your companion, and he shall lie with your wives in broad daylight. Indeed, you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and under the sun." Then David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." And Nathan said to David, "The Lord also has taken away your sin. You shall not die. However, because by this deed you have given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also that is born to you shall surely die." So Nathan went to his house. Okay. So this is what God has said through Nathan. That child is going to die. Because of what you've done, that child is going to die. Now look, I'll read on. Notice what David's response is. "Then the Lord struck the child that Uriah's widow bore to David, so that he was very sick. David therefore inquired of God for the child, and David fasted and went and lay all night on the ground. And the elders of his household stood beside him in order to raise him up from the ground, but he was unwilling and would not eat food with them. Then it happened on the seventh day that the child died, and the servants of David were afraid to tell him that the child was dead, for they said, 'Behold, while the child was still alive, we spoke to him, and he did not listen to our voice. How then can we tell him that the child is dead, since he might do himself harm?'" So David has decided he will fast. He lies down and he inquires of the Lord for God. So apparently, David is appealing to God to save the life of this child, even though Nathan had said, "This child is going to die." God says, "This child is going to die." Now his response in verse 19. "But when David saw that his servants were whispering together, David perceived that the child was dead. So David said to his servants, 'Is the child dead?' And they said, 'He is dead.' So David arose from the ground, washed, anointed himself, and changed his clothes. And he came into the house of the Lord and worshipped. Then he came to his own house, and when he requested, they set food before him, and he ate. Then his servants said to him, 'What is this thing that you have done? While the child was alive, you fasted and wept, but when the child died, you arose and ate food.' And he said, 'While the child was still alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, "Who knows? The Lord may be gracious to me, that the child may live. But now he has died, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he will not return to me." So David's attitude in this situation is, God has said, this child is going to die. And despite that, David thinks that there's a possibility that God will have mercy on David and allow the child to live. So he pleads to God that the child might live. And he does so fervently until the child dies. But once the child dies, David's attitude is, he didn't do it. God chose not to do it. Now let's go on with our life. Rather than cursing God and saying, God, how could you? His attitude is, God just chose not to do it. God chose not to listen to my plea. There are other instances of this, but I find this very helpful because there are so many times in my life when I run into miserable problems, situations that it's just, for one reason or another, it's agonizing. And yet, I don't know what to do. I don't know why I'm experiencing it. I don't know what God's doing. But I find myself asking God, take this away. Solve it. I mean, I don't know that I could respond differently. It's painful. But in the midst of it, I think it's good and proper to follow the attitude of David, and that is, I'm hoping God will respond. I'm hoping God will take this away. But if he doesn't, if God doesn't listen to my plea, then so be it. He knows what he's doing. I'm in no position to say, God, you have wronged me by not delivering me from this problem, by not solving this problem. So to kind of summarize how I think we can apply what we see in Exodus, we are not Israelites. We have not been made a promise that is quite like the promise that they received, that they would be return to the promised land. They had the promise that they would be delivered from their temporal bondage, and we have not received that kind of promise. However, I think that God's interaction with Israel was designed to be a picture. It is a picture of God dealing with his people, with God revealing himself to his people, with God working through their sufferings and using those sufferings to teach them something about him, and then ultimately delivering them. And by so doing, I think he has created a picture in history that is analogous to, it is not the same as, but is analogous to our life story as believers. Because God does a similar thing with us in that he reveals himself to us, puts us through a series of experiences, both good and bad, shows us his power, teaches us about himself, and teaches us about ourselves, and leads us towards true sanctification. So it's analogous, but it's not the same. It's a picture that has some similarities, but there are some differences. But we do see in it the typical human response to God's claim to be to our obedience, to be the master of our lives. And the Israelites fight that. It's a difficult thing for them to accept, just as it is difficult for us. And it also shows us God's justice as well as God's mercy, sinners. Okay, let me stop there and throw it open for questions about this particular issue.
I was listening to the command that it was a national day of prayer or something like that. Prayer was the Muslim topic, but some Christian spokesman was saying something to the effect that this is a day when we can show that as Christians we believe in something and that we believe in the power of prayer. And it was just a very succinct reminder of, I think, a view that's kind of implicit in so much of the teaching on the prayer, and that is that we can manage our lives through prayer, and that we are Christians who believe that we can control and manage our lives through prayer, and basically make our lives better and improve our lives if we will simply use prayer as a way to get God to improve prayer. And just what you're talking about, she showed us in 2 Samuel, is just completely contrary to that. From that perspective, his prayer has failed in some extent.
Anything else? Mm-hmm.
Just the same situation could be discussed, and if you had chosen an example where prayer was answered, and someone might choose to take Jack's approach and say, you see, we can manage our lives, and this is a good example of how prayer helps us to manage our lives. It would be, I think, good to discuss further the Old Testament experience and exposure is prophets and judges and appointed people talking with God much more openly and commonly, and it's there in print. It's not a New Testament experience, and it's not a modern day experience. And so when we make this comparison with the Old Testament, as you're trying to do now, to our lives today, there is the opportunity to conclude, maybe more often, the positive, that we can change things by prayer, and we see an immediate result. And so I would enjoy if you would put that in an even more direct perspective of what you think about prayer and its effect. Do we pray for the will of God? Do we pray for consequence? Indeed, you and I pray every day for consequence, for outcome. And we have to learn to accept what we get, if you will. Could you continue on with that idea a little bit more? Do you see what I mean about making a contrast to the Old Testament, where lots of times prayer was answered directly?
Well, some of this stuff is stuff that I'm still sorting out, but I think we have to keep in balance two things. One is God is sovereign, and his purposes are beyond our comprehension. We can't understand what he's doing and exactly how he's trying to achieve his purposes. The other is that God is a personal and compassionate God. And as a result, it seems to me that the biblical record indicates that he does indeed listen to us. He doesn't just listen to kings and prophets, but he listens to others as well. And he does care about our personal needs and concerns. And there are times when he chooses to address those very dramatically. But there are other times when he doesn't address them in a way that we recognize as him dealing with our situation, with our problem.
How about attacking it this way? When in apparent response to prayer, subsequent actions happen that are to our satisfaction. That was the desire of our prayer. Let's make it a serious prayer. Mm-hmm. Do we conclude, oh, good, that must have been in God's timing, just the way it was in mine. I was fortunate this time. Or do we conclude he is a personal God, and he really listened to me that time, and he's demonstrating the answer to me at this very moment when I wished for the answer. I think we can get messed up by that. I would find it difficult to think. If I was to think, boy, I'm pretty good, God just answered my prayer, I think that would be pretty dangerous for me to do that. And so my prayer is, even though personal, by golly, I got to be careful that I don't get it confused. And that's hard for me to do.
Well, it seems to me inescapable that God is interested in me as an individual, and that he indeed cares about my sufferings, that he's empathetic with my sufferings. And if that's the case, and if he is sovereign, then I think I can assume that there will be times when he will act compassionately towards me personally. That wouldn't surprise me. And furthermore, it wouldn't surprise me that it would be in response to my appeals for help. But to conclude then that it's something in me, it's my goodness or the way I prayed or there's something inherent in me that got God, compelled God to act in the way he did, I think would be a mistake.
Well, I think what strikes me about David's response is that there is a sense in which, whether he got what he wanted or not, he was using prayer to, quote, manage his life. And I think there's a way we can look at that that is important for me, even though I think for a long time I've been very confused about prayer and essentially just haven't messed with it unless I was desperate enough to have to do it. And I think that that is the sense that manage, in the sense that I'm trying to manage my way through this life. Another word for that could be endure, persevere in it. So whether or not I get what I want, and so it appears that either I have some influence over God or that that's just the way prayer works, is a different issue than the effectiveness and the usefulness and the teaching tool of prayer in my life, or that especially in the case of David, that he would appeal to the very end to his God to be merciful on him, and then accept that God's mercy was just more severe than he would prefer. But the prayer was was nonetheless extremely important to his managing his way through this part of his life. And I don't know how much credit we can give the contemporary church to say, oh yeah, that's what I mean. I'm not expecting God to give me what I want. Although, it seems like in word, almost anybody would say that. It seems dangerous that the underlying assumptions that since as a human being I want so badly for God to do what I say is best, that if I started getting results on a regular basis, whether I was willing to give intellectual assent to it or not, I think in my heart I would be struggling to not believe that I had gotten God figured out. But I think it's an important distinction.
You were using managing your life in a different sense, weren't you?
I was taking off on the concept of you believe in the power of prayer. I remember in the old TV series Roots, if you ever saw that, I can't remember, it might have been Roots, the second generation, but there was the protagonist wants to go to their aunt, I think it is, because she's a right powerful prayer. And the idea being that there are some people that are closer to God and somehow know the key to the right sort of prayer that gets results is the bottom line. And the point is that the power of prayer is that you can actually get what it is that you're asking for. And it seems to me, whether I don't know that we're all that explicit about it usually, but it seems to me that implicit in so much of the teaching is the idea that prayer is that kind of tool that can get results. But I certainly agree with you that that's exactly what prayer is, manage it in the sense that you're describing. I think it can help ourselves. But work out our relationship with God by talking it out with him. I think that's an instrumental.
Logan?
I think what Jack is talking about has come to the, it's the pinnacle, the peak of such an experience that they're building a war room in Colorado in the mountains, like NORAD's central war room where they have all their bases up on the big board. But they're actually building a prayer center. It's like a central command center for prayer where they have all the hot spots in the world up on a map and they have lights. It's like a war room, a situation room for prayer. And they're planning to have people come in there not to talk or eat donuts or drink coffee. He said, people that come in here will come here to pray, and it will bring the power of something to bear. And they're, because of all the losses Christianity is experiencing in the Muslim world, but they're actually, I mean, they're pouring millions, literally millions of dollars into the Christian equivalent of a war room bunker for prayer, to get to make things happen, to be a place that can't be bombed or infiltrated. Or, it's very strange, but it seems to me it's that philosophy taken to the absurd that's produced that. I read about Christianity Today. I'm not making this up. It's there.
Seems like Davis was dealing with some pretty harsh realities here. Yeah. Complex stuff. You know, he had created, you know, most of this mess himself. And, he was on his face. Mm-hmm. That seems to be, you know, that's sort of what prayer is.
Mm-hmm. I identify very closely with David in this situation, in that there is a very good sense in which most of my problems are of my own making. there are messes that I have created for myself, but the question is, how do I, it's not like I don't deserve, in a sense, a lot of what happens, but how do I cope with it? And that's where what David's saying is, rings true with me. It's just when I'm faced with problems, where else do I turn? I mean, it's appropriate to turn to God, and He's going to do what He's going to do. But as a human being, I don't seem to have any option but to pour my concerns out to God and let Him sort it out and deal with it the way He's going to deal with it. Margaret?
I like your emphasis on God as being empathetic and compassionate. And you see that. You see that in many places in the Bible. When you see Jesus, it talks about Jesus was moved with compassion. And Jesus is the image of God. That's something that for a long time was not tangible to me. I sort of, I don't know if I've ever believed that I had, that if I did something just the right way, I would twist God's arm. But I did sort of think of myself as, God had sort of an impersonal relationship to me the way I have to my chessmen, you know, that if I want to sacrifice this pawn in order to gain this other piece, well, it's my pawn. And I don't have any particular emotional connection to my pawn. It's mine to do with as I wish. And I think it's true that we are God's to do with as He wishes for His own purposes, but that really completely misses the picture that God, or that Jesus paints when He talks about the lilies of the field and that kind of thing. He says, "Wait a minute, we're talking about somebody who's your father here. This isn't the master chessman player. This is your father." And I started to get this picture of God as somebody who. Like any father who just dearly loved to spoil his children, but wasn't going to hurt them. He's actually restraining himself from pouring all sorts of delights all over our heads because he's got other things that need to be accomplished that are more important to us now. And I have a feeling that one of the big thrills when everything finally works itself out is God going to get a chance to spoil us the way He's been wanting to and hasn't been able to. So I used to think, well, if something good happened to me, it was just because it happened to work out in God's scheme. It wasn't He particularly was interested in making me happy. It was more that, well, this works for my plan. You know, I'm not sacrificing you, my calling, because it wasn't. My purpose is not to sacrifice you at this time, but later on, your time may come. That actually, instead of it's God throwing me a bone occasionally, it's God restraining Himself from throwing every treasure and delight at His disposal at me because something more significant was at stake.
I think one of the trickiest things about the biblical worldview is that we have to keep these things in balance and in tension. On the one hand, he's a personal God, but on the other hand, he's the sovereign creator. On the one hand, he's in control of everything, but on the other hand, we're responsible for our actions. And there are a lot of things that we have to keep in tension. And over time, and I find this in myself, I'll lose sight of one of those truths and end up kind of sliding off towards the polar opposite and getting things out of perspective. And one of the things that is most beneficial, I think, about reading scripture and hearing teaching regularly is the restoration of some of those balances that I have allowed to get out of kilter. And over time, it makes a big difference when you get out of kilter. It affects a lot of your thinking about your experience. And it helps to pull that back into perspective and see things through clear eyes again. I think that's the most... the Bible really has just a handful of things that it teaches. It just teaches those, that same handful of things over and over and over. And I think, in generally speaking, in hearing Bible teaching, you don't often hear new things. It's just the same old things from a little slightly different slant or a slightly different perspective. But we need to be reminded of those things time after time after time. Anything else? Jack?
It's a different issue, although it's related. You mentioned the individual Israelites in Egypt having a different story, that the promise of God to them may not impact their lives positively. They may die before they see any relief. I think I made this point when we were going through Hebrews, but the critical thing, it seems to me, is to realize that confronts each individual Israelite with a very crucial question, and that is, does the promise of God to them for deliverance, for exodus out of Egypt and deliverance into the promised land, do they respond to that positively or not? And so often, if we don't have the eyes to see, if the fact that that's not going to imply my liberation and my relief makes me not interested in that promise, that's no longer at all any relevance to me. Whereas it seems to me that the believers among the Israelites, were there any at the time, perhaps people like Moses, it's very interesting to them, even if they themselves don't get to be direct participants in it. And the reason, I think, ultimately, is because I do, in the end, ultimately, I am a direct participant in that kingdom that's been promised, that is going to be mine if everything along the line is true. If everything that God has promised along the line is true, then this coming kingdom that I will be a part of is also part of that truth. And it's important for God to stay on schedule, because everything about my ultimate fulfillment is at stake. So the fact that I may not directly benefit, I may die before the exodus happens, it doesn't keep me from finding joy in the fact that God has now sent his prophet into the land to lead us to freedom. That could be really exciting, even though I'm on my deathbed.
That's a good point. Very good point.
I can't think of a better prayer to connect both of Jack's points tonight, of being at the very extreme situation of wanting out, and yet respecting his father so strongly, as the one Christ says, let me out of this, but I'll do it.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a very important model. That humanly, there's something that he really, really would like, a solution that he would really, really like, and yet he brings himself to the point of saying, but not my will, but your will. And that's crucial. Yes?
I forget. Do you go to the quarter after?
That's what I'm supposed to do.
Okay, so I'm going to ask a question. The Lord went on to talk to David about how he was going to demonstrate his sin through his other wives, and then that calamity would come through his family. And I mean, that brings up a lot of other questions for me. It's a new nest of eggs to go into, but I wondered if you would begin looking at that. It looks like some of the pawns are being sacrificed for the sake of the king, or it looks like another promise of God that he needs to keep, or the tension again between justice and where's the mercy going to come through. And I just wonder if you could touch on why he chooses to demonstrate that this cursing are the sins of the sons. It looks like that pattern again where it carries on through the generations.
I'll bring up another story from the 2 Samuel that it's a story I've thought about a lot, and it in this kind of discussion it always comes back to me, and that's the one where David decided to move the Ark of the Covenant from where it had been temporarily stored to Jerusalem. And they load it onto the cart, and the cart takes off and hits some apparently some muddy ground, and the ark starts sliding off the wagon, and I can't remember his name, Uzzah reaches out to keep the ark from falling off, and God zaps him dead. And I've often wondered, I fully expect that it is possible that Uzzah will be in heaven. Is that his name, Uzzah? That Uzzah will be in heaven. That if you put yourself in his place, he's thinking, I've got to keep it from falling off. And yet they were commanded not to touch the ark. It may have just been, I mean, if I'd been in the situation, my brain doesn't work real well in crisis situations, and I forget things in crisis situations, and that would be something I might forget in a crisis situation, and reach out, whoops. But that would be a situation in which there was something that God wanted to demonstrate there. And Uzzah's life was something that God was willing to sacrifice for the sake of demonstrating something, and that is God's holiness. You don't mess with God. But at the same time, God may have been dealing with Uzzah in a... I mean, who knows what God was doing in his life? And I don't think we can conclude that the fact that God killed him at that point in time is necessarily an individual punishment for him. You think of the story in the New Testament where the Pharisees ask, whose fault is it that this man is, what was he, blind? And Jesus says, nobody's fault. It was so that I could heal him and demonstrate my power. So people have strange parts to play in this drama that God has crafted. And there's a sense in which we are pawns. We are playing roles that God has set out before us. But there's another sense in which in the midst of that, God is dealing with us as individuals. There's a sense in which there's this separate subplot, and that is God's dealing with me. And that is a very personal interaction.
I think I hear what you're saying. It isn't, he doesn't always deal the same way. And sometimes you get to be, God said to David, basically, it seems like David was starting to feel pretty powerful and take credit for some of the victories that God has given to him. And God reminds him that I did those. And then his response after being found out for his sin is humility. And that leads him to prayer, and that maybe prayer is a chance to become more involved in God's plan. But he doesn't always use you as, you don't always get to put your hand in his if it feels that way and help him help shape his promises, sometimes maybe make a bend in the river of his promise around you getting to be involved, and sometimes you don't get to be aware, and maybe sometimes he affects very strongly how we feel and we don't have a choice. I mean, he hardens Pharaoh's heart later, and I mean, I struggle with that because I guess I keep expecting God to be consistent the way I want him to be, and yet maybe he is consistent in a way that is bigger than that allows for these variances. So I put myself in one of David's wives' shoes, of course. Just being a woman, it's like, well, what about those poor women?
Yes.
That theoretically they would have the opportunity in their own humility to ask for God's mercy and maybe make a bend in his promise, but he would still be true. Would you say that, theoretically?
Yes.
And it wouldn't be wrong or right.
We don't know what God is doing in the lives of those wives. It turns out to be his concubines, and Absalom, his son, makes a claim on the throne and sets up a tent on top of the palace and sleeps with all the concubines that have been left after David and the rest of the people have fled. We don't know what God's doing in their lives. And God works in very strange ways. It may be that each of those concubines would respond differently to being raped. And God has set them up differently for it. I mean, God's been working in their lives differently for it. But our confidence is that God knows what he's doing, that he is capable of weaving all of these threads together and not losing track of any of those threads. That he's able to deal with each of those people as individuals and yet carry on his main storyline. We just don't have a record of all of those subplots, all of those, how he's dealing with each of those concubines. But if we did, I think what we would see is God's faithfulness to his promises, the fact that he's working out his purposes, and that in the lives of believers, he's moving them on towards sanctification.
Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the remainder of this talk.